Today at Reader's Corner, Megan L. O'Sullivan, author of Windfall, How the Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Energy has been a driver of some of the most important events from the last century. From World War I onward, oil has been a key factor in the economies and foreign policies of every major player on the global stage. But with rapid technological developments and the unconventional oil boom, that power is shifting. In this encore edition of Reader's Corner, we talk with Megan O'Sullivan about her book Windfall, How the Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. In the book, O'Sullivan pulls back the curtain on our ever-changing energy markets. O'Sullivan is a former Deputy National Security Advisor on Iraq and Afghanistan. She is Jean Kirkpatrick Professor of the Practice of International Affairs and Senior Fellow at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. She is also the director of the Geopolitics of Energy Project, which explores the complex interactions between energy markets and international affairs. She joins us today by Skype. Megan L. O'Sullivan, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for being interested.
Well, Megan, one of your colleagues, Joseph Nye, according to your book, used to end his meetings by saying, "How could we be wrong?" And I thought of that in the context of your opening chapter or two, where you talk about the work of Marion King Hubbert, who gave a dire warning at a regional meeting of the American Petroleum Institute. That might be an interesting place to start this discussion, thinking back on how people thought it was going to be and how we are today.
Right. It's good to start with a sobering note, because I think although there are so many interesting and exciting trends to point to, it's useful to keep in mind how often humans have misjudged the trajectory of, in particular, technology. And so you mentioned Marion Hubbert, and back in the 50s, he was making predictions about when the United States was going to reach what he called peak oil production. And from making predictions about the United States, he also made predictions about the world. And the idea was quite simple, that it took hundreds of millions of years for dinosaur bones and other things to turn into oil, and that the world was using oil at an increasing pace. And it was just inevitable that it would get harder and harder to produce this resource, and there would become less and less of it. And eventually, the world would be in a situation where it did not have enough oil to meet its needs. And actually, his projections turned out to be right, at least it appeared that way for the United States in 1971, when it did peak oil produce and then started a slow decline. But really, what I write about in my book is how the United States in particular has seen an amazing revival in its oil and gas production in the last 10 years. And this is largely a story about technology and innovation and some government assistance, but all of these things coming together to really push the boundaries of what people thought they knew to be true.
And I gather that one of the people who had something to do with this, a lot to do with this, is a fellow by the name of George Mitchell, who clearly plays a major role in one of these new developments.
Exactly. George Mitchell, he was the son of Greek goat herders. He was born made his fortune in Texas. And he was someone who really had a vision. He basically bought a vast tract of land, or he bought the rights to develop the energy resources of a vast tract of land in Texas. And everybody knew that there was a lot of natural gas beneath this land, but it wasn't natural gas of the usual variety. It was natural gas that was trapped in these little bubbles and rocks. So actually, rather than seeing a reservoir of natural gas, you just saw solid rock, and the gas was in those rocks. And the challenge that George Mitchell took on was to try to find a way to liberate the gas from those rocks and to actually produce it at a cost that made economic sense. And basically, he pursued this, and I described this in some detail. He pursued this for decades. He threw hundreds of millions of dollars at this problem. And it's interesting, if you really get into his background, it strained his relationships with his company, with his board, even with his own family, as people thought he was just really going beyond what made practical sense that he should have given up on this project a long time ago. But in fact, if there's one person who we can attribute progress in fracking to the most, it's George Mitchell. He obviously wasn't alone, but all of his pursuits actually did finally lead to a combination of factors, which allowed him and then subsequently other small companies to release that gas and to produce it at a price that made economic sense.
You mentioned the role that technology is playing in the new energy abundance, and that does remind me of the role that wind and solar and increasingly and improved technologies is playing in alternative energy. What role does alternative energy play in this new energy abundance, if any?
Well, it certainly does play a role, and I would say that that role is bound to grow more and more as technologies improve and renewable energies become even more cost competitive. Essentially, the book is premised on the idea that when there's a big shift in energy, that there's a big shift in politics. And we see two things happening. We see a boom in unconventional oil and gas production, but we also see this shift, this movement away from fossil fuels to a more sustainable global energy mix. And it's a slow process, but it certainly is underway. And my expectation is that it will continue, and technology may even allow it to increase. Now, because the world still relies on fossil fuels for 81% of its energy consumption, a lot of geopolitics of energy still centers around fossil fuels. But if we look a little bit into the future, where renewables may command an even greater amount of global energy consumption, I think we can anticipate that there may be questions around what we know as the resource curse, not for countries that are developing renewable energy, but for countries that are supplying things like cobalt and lithium to makers of renewable energy technology. We may not have a lot of geopolitics around the trade of solar and wind because, in fact, a lot of that energy will be consumed in the country where it is produced, but we'll certainly have geopolitics and political tensions around the trade of renewable energy technologies. We also will find that certain countries, and I'm thinking of China in particular, that have invested a lot in the development of new technologies into alternative energies will almost certainly have a geopolitical edge because of it, because more and more countries will be looking to rein in their carbon emissions, be good to their environments at the same time as they promote economic growth. And if China is the country that has the best technologies to allow them to do that, China is going to have more geopolitical influence in the international community. So again, it's an area where I think we have to watch because the shift in our energy mix is going to have a lot of impact on the nature of geopolitics.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Megan L. O'Sullivan, author of Windfall. You know, for those of us who remember the 70s, obviously Saudi Arabia was the bad guy. OPEC was the evildoer that was moving oil up and down and really causing some serious price problems for the United States and especially the drivers. One of the things your book points out is that you're pretty much convinced that the future of oil and the oil markets will not be dictated quite as much by OPEC as it has been in the past.
No, I think that's one of the most interesting geopolitical implications. Of course, we're still hearing about OPEC. OPEC still matters to global oil markets, but those countries have a lot less influence over the oil markets that they did in the past. And a lot of this has to do with America's new contribution to oil markets. And it's not just that America is producing more oil, importing less oil, and actually exporting oil. It has to do with the fact that America's new resource, we could call it unconventional oil or tight oil, as I call it in my book. It is the oil that is produced by fracking, much like the natural gas we just talked about. That particular kind of oil has a different business model. And to make a long story short, that business model involves relatively small investments and quick payoffs. So you can decide you're going to invest money relatively small amounts of money, and you're going to get oil very quickly. And in the past, OPEC always was reliant on the idea that actually, if they raise the price of oil by cutting production, they were going to be the ones to reap the benefits of that oil price. And it was going to take a long time before other actors thought it made sense to make big investments, wait the years it took to develop big fields, and to produce more oil. And so in this new environment, where if the price goes up, lots of new producers come online and produce more oil almost immediately, OPEC doesn't have the same power over the market that it used to have. And as a result, we've really seen OPEC flounder. It went from, one, pursuing a strategy that actually had a lot more to do about maximizing individual countries' market share than it did about influencing price. Now OPEC is onto a different strategy, which involves them banding together with 11 non-OPEC players, including Russia, to try to influence global markets. But if you can imagine how difficult it was to keep just the countries of OPEC together, imagine how difficult it is to keep an organization twice the size of that with twice as many varied interests. So basically, you know, I say that OPEC has this situation where it's basically on a diet. In order to lose weight, it needs to eat less and less, or in order to make a difference, you know, it has to cut more and more oil production. And at the end of the day, these difficulties have led these countries to think very differently about their national oil strategies.
Meanwhile, back in the United States, every time there's an election, at least for national office, you have politicians calling for energy independence. And in your book, you give a very interesting analysis of what that energy independence really should be, as opposed to the perhaps more simplistic way that some Americans may look at it, like we can be completely independent of any energy source outside of the United States. Could you explain that?
Sure. In the book, I call energy independence America's unrequited love, because really, since President Nixon, every single president has talked about the need for America to become more self-sufficient. And this is a concept that has gotten new purchase with this boom in American oil and gas, with a lot of people thinking that America has now become energy independent in the sense of being self-sufficient. The reality is that in the sense of meeting all of its own energy needs, America is very unlikely. It's not energy independent now, and it won't become energy independent barring some new resource discoveries and new advances in technology. Because the balance is still that America is exporting some forms of energy and importing other forms of energy, and the critical energy form of oil, it still is consuming more than it is producing, and that's likely to be the case for a long time. Now, I say that shouldn't be a source of sadness for Americans, because the reality is this idea, I think, is really overplayed, that it is not, except maybe under very exceptional circumstances, in America's interest to pursue being energy self-sufficient, that actually America can be energy secure in the sense of not needing to warp its foreign policy to pursue access to energy, but it can be energy secure if global markets work. And that is a strategy that America has pursued, and it has become a strategy that is even easier for the United States to pursue because it is more engaged in global markets. America is an energy importer and an energy exporter. It's deeply engaged in global markets, and its energy security lies in the continuation of those markets working so that it is markets rather than political forces that are distributing energy from producers to consumers around the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the difference between the market forces and the political forces. The energy boom that we're currently enjoying, as you say in your book, is certainly subject to change. And sustaining the boom, as you say, is a challenge when it comes to public support for fracking. And you address that and suggest that while we're enjoying this energy abundance, who knows what the future holds? Help us understand that.
Sure. No, I think that that's very right. And I talk about some of the benefits to the United States in terms of what it has meant for the economies, both at the federal level and the state level. But of course, as I mentioned, there are also significant downsides, and some of them are not just the environmental concerns that many people are familiar with about water or even earthquakes now. Some of them have to do with social impacts of big fluxes of people coming in to communities and leaving, being cyclical, having trucks moving through communities at a very high pace, carrying sand and water and these types of things. So there is a lot of disruption that has come with fracking. But what I would say, when I'm looking at the geopolitical impact of this, I'm trying to encourage policymakers who are thinking about the cost and benefits of this technology to at least include geopolitics in the benefits. That basically, the production of American oil and gas through this technology has provided economic benefits, but it's also provided geopolitical benefits, and I think we'll talk about that. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question more directly, I think even though the Trump administration is clearly very, very favorable to fracking and to oil and gas production, there are other forces at work in our country, and there are communities and there are states that are still calling into question whether this is the right practice for their communities. And even if we look at some initiatives, there are efforts to try to constrain the practice of fracking or outright ban it. And I'm thinking about Colorado in particular. So I think that especially given that it is states that have such control, as I think is appropriate, over whether fracking is allowed in their locale or not, we might have a national trend that has a number of states moving in the opposite direction.
You mentioned the role that technology is playing in the new energy abundance, and that does remind me of the role that wind and solar and increasingly and improved technologies is playing in alternative energy. What role does alternative energy play in this new energy abundance, if any?
Well, it certainly does play a role, and I would say that that role is bound to grow more and more as technologies improve and renewable energies become even more cost competitive. Essentially, the book is premised on the idea that when there's a big shift in energy, that there's a big shift in politics. And we see two things happening. We see a boom in unconventional oil and gas production, but we also see this shift, this movement away from fossil fuels to a more sustainable global energy mix. And it's a slow process, but it certainly is underway. And my expectation is that it will continue, and technology may even allow it to increase. Now, because the world still relies on fossil fuels for 81% of its energy consumption, a lot of geopolitics of energy still centers around fossil fuels. But if we look a little bit into the future, where renewables may command an even greater amount of global energy consumption, I think we can anticipate that there may be questions around what we know as the resource curse, not for countries that are developing renewable energy, but for countries that are supplying things like cobalt and lithium to makers of renewable energy technology. We may not have a lot of geopolitics around the trade of solar and wind because, in fact, a lot of that energy will be consumed in the country where it is produced, but we'll certainly have geopolitics and political tensions around the trade of renewable energy technologies. We also will find that certain countries, and I'm thinking of China in particular, that have invested a lot in the development of new technologies into alternative energies will almost certainly have a geopolitical edge because of it, because more and more countries will be looking to rein in their carbon emissions, be good to their environments at the same time as they promote economic growth. And if China is the country that has the best technologies to allow them to do that, China is going to have more geopolitical influence in the international community. So again, it's an area where I think we have to watch because the shift in our energy mix is going to have a lot of impact on the nature of geopolitics.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Megan L. O'Sullivan, author of Windfall. In the book, O'Sullivan describes the shifting global energy landscape and how the United States is its greatest beneficiary. So let's take a trip around the world, at least part of the world. Let's talk about Europe for a moment. If shale gas development is such a big deal here and so productive, then why doesn't Europe turn to it?
That's a great question. Europe, if we just look at it geologically, it appears that Europe has a significant amount of shale gas, not necessarily oil, and not as much as the United States, but enough to potentially make an appreciable difference to the energy balance in European countries. However, as you suggest, outside of the United Kingdom, there's been virtually no progress in developing this resource. And there are a number of reasons for that. The first and most important one I would highlight is just concerns over the environmental effects. So if you think about it, Europe is much more densely populated than many parts of the United States. And as we've already discussed, fracking, the method of extracting the shale gas, can be very disruptive and can involve a lot of disruption to local communities. And if you think about one of the largest basins of shale gas in Europe is called the Paris Basin. It happens to be right under Paris. There are just places in Europe that are not going to be interested in developing that resource, regardless of how strategic they might think that it is. So one, I would say environment is probably the largest factor, but there are other issues as well. Many countries in Eastern Europe that have been keen on developing their natural gas resources have found that suddenly environmental groups have sprung up to really, really protest this. And there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that many of these groups are funded by Russia, because Russia obviously has a real interest in seeing that Europe does not develop its own independent natural gas resources, because Russia is very highly dependent on Europe being its number one gas customer. So there are a lot of political reasons, and there's a whole range of other reasons having to do with property rights and institutional frameworks that also make it less likely that Europe will ever develop its shale resources to the extent that the United States has.
Well, I was reading your book on this same subject of who Russia is cozying up to. I ran across a foreign affairs article recently that highlighted another meeting with the Russian and Chinese premiers, and it raises the issue of the attempt by Russia and China to work together. And what role does energy play in this? How does this new energy abundance and Putin's problems in Russia play as far as China is concerned? Now we're getting really complicated, I understand.
But it's a very, very important relationship. And most watchers of international affairs for years have been a little bit perplexed why Russia and China have not forged a closer political relationship. And people anticipated that energy should be kind of the foundation of that relationship. You have Russia, one of the world's largest energy producers, and you have China, one of the world's largest energy consumers, sharing a border, you know, thousands of miles long. So it turns out that China is dependent on Russian energy, but not in a way that means that Russia has any political leverage really over China, because China is finding that it can get its energy needs met by a lot of other countries. And literally last year, China's importation of liquefied natural gas, so that's natural gas by ship, so not from Russia, increased by 50%. And China became one of the world's largest importers of natural gas just within a one-year period. And actually, the United States became a significant exporter of natural gas to China. So essentially, where Russia had hoped there would be this very strong mutual dependence, in fact, what we're seeing is this energy abundance mean China has a lot of options for where it gets its energy, and Russia will just be one of many suppliers.
And this leads us directly to the last part of your book, where you talk about moving from serendipity to strategy. And your point really is embedded in the subtitle of your book, How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. Talk with us a little bit about how you see the United States using this energy abundance for our own global political ends.
Sure. And this, I think, is this is a very much a topic that's unfolding in front of us every single day. So I used to work in government. I worked for President George W. Bush, and we would often, as is true for every administration, get assessments about America's standing in the world. What are our strengths? What are our vulnerabilities? And without fail, we were always reminded that one of America's big vulnerabilities was that it was so dependent on energy produced in foreign countries. Now, with the Trump administration, President Trump is the first president to come into office where energy is much more of an asset than a liability. And that has certainly not gone without notice. It's a point of pride and a point of strength for the president and for the United States. But I think what we're still seeing is that American policymakers, while they now understand this to be the case, they haven't fully developed the tool set to figure out how they're going to use this new reality to their advantage. The tendency thus far, I think, has been, as is understandable as a former policymaker, but the tendency has been to think, well, you know, we're going to use this in some kind of weaponization way. You know, we had OPEC use oil against us. We're now going to, because we're an exporter, we're going to find ways of trying to extract political leverage from other countries if they're going to buy our energy. I really think that would be a mistake. I think we need to stay away from making our energy trade too political. Because as I mentioned earlier, the United States, our energy security really depends on global markets functioning smoothly without a lot of political interference. And we've already started to see that in some parts of the world, people are concerned about if they become customers of American oil and gas exports, are those exports going to be subject to political whims? And certainly the U.S. use of sanctions, which is, you know, pretty frequent, adds to that question. You know, to what extent is America going to use its energy exports to advance its political agenda? And in that case, wouldn't it be better, you know, not to rely on American mm-hmm. exports? So I think there's still a lot of thinking about what this means for American foreign policy. And my advice is really to err on the side of letting markets work. And secondly, to acknowledge that America's energy boom is doing a lot for American geopolitical interest simply by reshaping markets in a way that makes it harder for Russia to exert influence over Europe or keeps the Russians and the Chinese from building a strategic relationship, that we're already getting geopolitical gains without having to pull very direct strings related to politics when it comes to energy.
In terms of the United States using energy to advance the political goals of the country, as you're pointing out, you close your book, Megan, with some thoughts on how we can use energy as a means to achieve wider goals. And I certainly would want, and we're just about out of time, but I certainly would want you to comment on how that new power of ours might be used as far as climate change is concerned and other wider goals that you suggest in your book.
Sure. And I think climate change is maybe the most important and obvious example to give in our limited time. That it essentially, as some people will be aware, the big boom in natural gas in the United States allowed America to do a pretty dramatic switch from coal to natural gas. And this had very, very positive effects for America's carbon emissions. We had the lowest carbon emissions per capita in more than 20 years. And this was not because of policy. It was mostly because the market and cheap natural gas encouraged people to move away from coal. This created some openings for President Obama, and they'll exist for President Trump and for subsequent presidents, to basically recapture a global leadership role on the issue of climate change, which President Obama used to, one, first go to the Chinese and talk about how these two countries can work together on a common agenda, and that America has some credibility in getting down its emissions because of this trend that we've seen, and two, to translate that bilateral agreement into a larger global agreement, again, where America was a more credible leader on this issue because of its ability to get some of its emissions under control, which, you know, was a lot to do with our boom in natural gas rather than to do with other factors at play. So I think, you know, obviously right now with the withdrawal from Paris, the United States is not a leader on climate issues, but I think that there's still the possibility that America could reclaim that role in future administrations. And, you know, perhaps our states and companies and other localities are busy to preserve that possibility as well.
Megan O'Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Again, the name of the book is Windfall, How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. Megan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Bob. It's my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of Reader's Corner. Next week, author and journalist David Nywert talks with us about his book, Of Orcas and Men. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.